Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Socey. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And joining me in studio of Midwest Film Journal fame, Paddington correspondent, new dad, Evan Dossey. Hi, Ev.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here. Now, you had something on the website. You had a combination of Japanese monster movies with a Judy Blume title. What did you recently just finish writing for the journal?
Yeah, so after several years, and I did read Judy Blume's book in preparation.
Oh my gosh!
I published a 9-part series. Are You There, Godzilla? It's me, Evan.
which you reminded me you made the declaration here.
I did
way back when.
I did when first time I was on the show after we launched our site. I said I was going to do it, and it took 2 years, but it happened. It finally, you know.
How many films?
34.
34 films.
Yes.
Including some of the...
including every Toho-produced Godzilla film, every Mothra, Rodan, well, the original Mothra. There are like 5 other Mothra movies I just couldn't bring myself to watch.
And no Gamera films.
No Gamera yet.
Yet.
That's for...
Have you come up with a pithy title for Gamera?
Not yet, but...
Or something involving Mystery Science, you know, Turtle Meat. The Turtle Meat Diaries.
Oh, I will be honest, I do own all the Gamera movies. So they're just
like
sitting there.
As
ready.
Is.
As
not
is.
The Mystery Science Theater ones.
Well, I own those too.
I own those as well.
Yeah.
So now, ladies and gentlemen, just so it's clear, I mentioned that he's a new dad. In case you're wondering how are things at his household, his wife's a critic too.
Yeah. Lots of I'll watch this movie while you sleep and hold him. And so on and so forth. So I think he's seen Avengers Infinity War 5 times.
Why?
Or at least he's, you know, he's just, a, you know, at 2 a.m., that's a good movie that just keeps you awake. That's all you need it to do.
Well, we're gonna exchange some film dad sage wisdom in a little bit. But this was all gearing up for Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Now, to remind folks, it was 2014.
Yeah.
Wow, it's been that long. But I remember really enjoying the last Godzilla movie because... Well, and for a lot of these, of course, technology is caught up with. So, you know, it's not Rick Baker or somebody who's Japanese answer of Rick Baker in a suit.
Yeah.
But you have grown actors. You had in the last Godzilla movie, you had folks like Bryan Cranston, Juliette Binoche, Sally Hawkins, Getty Watanabe. You know, all knew exactly what type of film that they were working on. And it just hit the right tones. And it was enjoyable. So I guess I'm asking you, I know, and then there was Kong, which was kind of the junior varsity version of that. I mean, it still had good players in it, but, you know.
Apocalypse Now
tribute
film.
Little Apocalypse Now tribute film, yeah. Little silly. Because there's a face-off between King Kong and Samuel L. Jackson. It's silly. So I know Warner Brothers has not been shy of saying there will be a Godzilla versus King Kong film, but this isn't it. This is the stepping stone film. This is the Quantum of Solace of the Godzilla movies.
This is the every single toy in the toy box on the screen as quickly as possible to get them out of the way and get to Kong Land.
This is their Infinity War.
Very much so.
Okay,
yeah.
So who all is involved in this? We'll get to the humans. Who is Godzilla fighting in this battle royale on an airstrip?
So it's a tiny bit prettier.
And Tom Holland shows up, really excited to be there.
Tiny bit prettier than the airstrip Civil War battle, but you have Godzilla's arch nemesis from the classic series, the three-headed dragon, King Ghidorah,
okay.
Monster Zero. You have Mothra, his stalwart ally, and you have Rodan, the useless pterodactyl, who, you know, is basically there to... Because, you know, you throw him in a movie, you don't have to worry about saving him for another one.
So you said or before we went on air that Rodan's a fairly useless character.
Yeah.
How was he handled in the original Japanese version?
Well, actually, in the original Japanese, Rodan is a fantastic horror movie.
Okay.
Because it's of that era where you don't really see the monster. You just see them looking up at the sky screaming. Then the girl falls down, close up on the shoe, oh my gosh, what happened?
Right.
But in every other subsequent Godzilla movie where he shows up, he's just, you know, kind of a shoddy looking suit that flaps its wings and gets hit by things. Although in the original Ghidorah, the Three-Headed Dragon, of which King of the Monsters borrows heavily, there's a scene where the caterpillar Mothra sits on top of Rodan and shoots its spinneret while he flies around. That's pretty sweet. But otherwise, he's... He just sort of shows up and dies.
Who is Rodan in the Marvel Universe?
Oh, gosh, I'm not even prepared to answer that question.
This is the hard-hitting questions here at Film Sociology. Yeah, you haven't done that comparison yet? You really haven't done?
I really haven't.
Maybe that's the next
column. I'm ashamed
column.
Of myself.
No,
yeah.
No, you haven't. Wow. Well, the next night you can't sleep and you have a baby on your lap, you can start working on that. So.
Oh, it's going to happen.
Okay, so... I know Vera Farmiga's in this.
Yes.
Ken Watanabe is back. Sally Hawkins
Kyle
is back.
Chandler.
Kyle Chandler, okay.
It's kind of bringing up, as opposed to the first movie, you know, the first movie took a lot of, like, A-list TV stars, like Bryan Cranston coming in, and A-list movie actors, mixed them together. This is all, like, B-plus team movie or TV players. Like, yeah,
and yes,
Chandler.
We know they still make more money and more famous than us. We know.
Sure. You got Bradley Whitford doing his Josh Lyman thing from West Wing. Only this time he's angry about monsters and not politics.
Okay. All right.
But you got the kid from Silicon Valley.
Okay.
I don't even remember his name. I feel real bad now.
That's
oh,
all
man.
Right. That kid. We do that a lot. So how are the humans in this one? Are they just as interesting than the last film?
In the last film, the humans, you know, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the last film's human characters. They were all just there as a means to see the monster.
Right.
In this one, it's fairly similar, but it plays like a 60s science fiction movie, even like the American ones, like Them, where you have like the stoic, heroic guy and the wife and the kid and the kid's curious. And, you know, they're all of that type.
Let me speak. So by curious, you mean irritating.
A little bit. But but it is Millie Bobby Brown from... Stranger Things shows she has the talent to back up the kid role.
But because this is an American film, there are no Japanese boys in short pants.
No.
It's a little unnerving.
Yeah.
All right, how are the big fight scenes? And I know the film's like what, 215, so it starts at about what, 150?
It does, you know, it's surprisingly well balanced. There are different fights throughout. The destruction's like exciting. A lot of people compared it to Armageddon or Michael Bay, which is fair enough, but like
no crummy Aerosmith ballad.
Yeah, and you know, Michael Bay does one thing well, and it's the destruction. So it's
did you dare bring this up to your lovely wife?
I you know, the Michael Bay train has left the Dossie Cavanaugh's household.
You live in a Bay free zone.
You know, Nick Rogers and I talk about Michael Bay all the time, and he hasn't seen King of the Monsters yet, fellow writer Nick Rogers, but we're going to the IMAX screening tomorrow at 10 p.m., so I'm hoping that the
So guess what? If you see two doughy white guys sitting next to each, it's them.
Oh, yeah. No tickets have apparently been sold for that yet, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
But sorry, so did you enjoy it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I loved it, and... But it is the kind of movie where I feel like the charms are limited to the audience that's receptive to them. I think that if you're not gonna, Richard Probst had a great review where he said, "Is it dumb? Yes. Does it make any sense? No.
No.
But you know, it is what it is, and."
And I know we know audiences love to hear critics just kind of state the obvious, but there are some of those that you ask for it and it. It delivers that, and that's all you're really asking.
Sure.
Okay.
I feel that way, and I mean, the monster fights, they're pretty sweet.
Yeah?
There's some sweet stuff in there, and Godzilla himself is hilarious, just because the way they've rendered the character. There are all these weird close-ups on his face where it almost looks like he's smiling. It's you don't know if it's supposed to be humorous, but you can't help but like just really think it's great.
There
like
you
almost
go.
Almost tongue in cheek.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, and then when's the main event supposed to happen?
The Godzilla vs. Kong.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, exactly. A year from now, they filmed.
Oh,
it
a year
already.
From now. Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow. So there you go, folks. So the as I said, the quantum of solace of the Godzilla movies as stepping stone. So, well, you saw Godzilla last night. I watched Rocket Man, or as I like to call. For those that thought the dirt was too butch, you have.
How was it? How was it compared to Bohemian Rhapsody?
Okay,
especially?
And there's going to be a lot of comparisons to Bohemian Rhapsody for a couple reasons. One, the director of this film, of course, took over for Bryan Singer on Bohemian Rhapsody, and he had already worked with the star on Eddie the Eagle.
Yeah,
that picture, and Taron Egerton, who's playing Elton John, and it also I forgot that because of his performance in the Nobody Saw This animated film Sing, because he's saying I'm Still Standing, that probably led to him getting this gig. So there's a Sing now has a footnote in the movie world.
Did you see Kingsman 2, The Golden Circle?
I did not. I saw the first one.
Yeah. Elton
first
John has a very large supporting role
does
in that,
he?
Too. So I've always wondered if they...
They must really bond quickly. So anyway, what I said about Bohemian Rhapsody at the time, Bohemian Rhapsody is a cinematic greatest hits album. This is a cinematic Vegas show. And... what I mean by it is, and I'm going to quote my buddy, my darling dear friend, Laura Jansen, who said many, many years ago, I don't like biopics because they're movies about people. And what she means by it is the story arc, the biopic story arc, which, you know, music biopics are cinematic comfort food, especially now. They're even after getting eviscerated in the film Walk Hard, which is an underutilized, underseen film and funny as hell, and they still make them.
Did you see they recently published an oral history behind Walk Hard?
No.
Yeah.
Of Vanity Fair?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I will look for that. But they still make them. They still make them. So what this one tries to do different than Rhapsody, besides being rated R and have the actor do his own singing, is they go for a surrealist attempt. The film opens, and this is not a spoiler, the film opens with Elton John in one of his garish stage frocks going into group therapy.
Interesting.
And then we get into the flashbacks to him as a child. And it's not just Elton John singing. There's a lot of people singing in this. So, you know, his younger version of him in a kind of distilled, not quite black and white, but very colorless English town. And a little five-year-old boy singing The Bitch Is Back. So, and then you have, you know, guess what? Terrible childhood. Bryce Dallas Howard is the mother, and you know, dad is gone, mom cares less, but still there. And then we get to build up in his younger days. And the other thing that happens with the surrealism, I think, is and this I have to warn some of the serious music nerds, I'm one of them, because they're going for a surrealist point, don't look at a timeline. And a great example is the first show that John has, famous concerts that Elton John had at the Troubadour in Los Angeles in 1970. In the film, he performs Crocodile Rock, which he didn't record until 2 years later. But there's a scene where John and the audience are literally elevated by the performance.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's that, and there's another moment where you see him recording Don't Go Breaking My Heart with Kiki D, and... you know, if you're thinking from a literal standpoint, I'm like, that's 1978. This is, I think, 1975. So stop thinking about literal sense of this.
I like the way you described it as a Vegas show then.
It is, because there are some literal dance numbers and other people singing. The other thing with Bohemian Rhapsody is there was a lot of scenes, obviously, where it's the making of. So there's a lot of scenes of them in the studio, and somebody will either say something or they'll play something, and then bang, a song is born. Yeah, I went there. That's kind of like this, where there's a life moment with Elton, and you can hear the song coming.
Yeah.
There is a lot of that. And if you're a fan of Elton John's work, you can see these coming a mile away. So there is that, and then there is a rise and a fall, and he comes back, and the thing I will give John credit for, he's a producer on this, was apparently the studio really kind of wanted a PG-13 version like Rhapsody, and he's like, no.
Yeah.
And they don't hold back. I mean, they could have gone a lot. It wasn't Sacha Baron Cohen level, but they acknowledge he drank a lot and screwed a lot and snorted a lot and popped a lot.
Yeah.
And so they don't hide that. But yeah, expect more musical numbers in this than, say, the rock concert of Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah. It's uneven, and it's okay. My daughter, who saw Rhapsody, didn't see this, made a point of saying, my little 17-year-old hipster, of, you know what bothers me is that they're making these for those who don't know anything about the artists. I went, yes, honey, that's the majority of the world, the mall crowd. So you, Emma, if you like Queen or you're interested in Elton John, yeah, find a documentary or go through the discography and you can start to plow through it.
They have tours to advertise.
Well, he's done touring.
Is he? I thought, okay.
Yeah, he said he's retired from touring and there's a nice little rep. The other part, the part I really like is the relationship with Elton John and Bernie, played by Jamie Bell. Billy Elliot for you folks. Because Bernie is the one, he really has kept himself out of the spotlight compared to Elton John gravitating toward the spotlight. And it's a really nice brotherly relationship and a work relationship. And Jamie Bell gets one really cool moment of song, and it's one of my favorite parts.
I feel like Jamie Bell, I mean, Billy Elliot aside, he's like, he's going to have that role. He's going to have another role that's going to be definitive in some way.
And he's been able to, I don't know if it's redefined, but he's been able to work on stuff, and he's become even, I think, is he still in his 20s?
He's shockingly young.
Yes, yeah. But he is one, I think he's one of the youngest actors that I can think of saying he's always good even if the material is. This is a dude that survived Fantastic Four.
Yes, he.
And came off, I mean, nobody said a bad thing about him in that film. Yeah. And he's still obviously still working and still working on different various projects that interest him. So, but yeah, I really like that relationship in this.
Yeah,
so
I'm kind of excited to see Rocket Man. But I'm sort of glad to hear the way you describe it and that it jumps all over the place and feels like a show. And
yeah. It's interesting because we complain, you know, like I said, we complain about the biopic story arc. And then if we try to flip it or switch it.
Yeah.
For me, the best example of flipping the story arc of a music bio, and you can't do this with everybody, is Todd Haynes' I'm Not Here.
Oh, yeah.
About Bob Dylan, which had, you know, 9-12 different configurations of Bob Dylan because it's Bob Dylan.
It'd be hard to do with pretty much anyone else.
Anyone else. So, and of course, one of the trailers with the film was Renee Zellweger as Judy Garland, which is coming later this year. So, So anyway, that is out there. I think some folks are going to like it more than I. But Bohemian Rhapsody, the best use of Elton John music in a film is not in the Elton John biopic. Still, I said this about Queen because I think the best use of Queen in a movie. No, it's not Iron Eagle, it's not Flash Gordon, it's Don't Stop Me Now from Shaun of the Dead.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's the funniest thing, cracks me up to this day. And The Onion, the AV Club, had two articles about Elton John in cinema, and both articles failed to notice an underrated, dear Criterion, the 1985 comedy Fandango. It is the film directing debut of Kevin Reynolds. It stars a then unknown Kevin Costner. Judd Nelson was the big name in this. This was, I think, a year before Silverado. And they use Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting at the beginning of the film. It's four college guys who just graduated 1971 Texas, and they're road tripping to Mexico. And it captures the spirit and the energy of that film. And it's the best thing Kevin Reynolds has ever directed. And that's not saying a lot, but his best film was his smallest and his cheapest film. We'll just leave it at that. So
never seen that, but
you have to look. It was one of the first films that Amblin Entertainment put out. Yeah, so apparently, I think Reynolds was a Spielberg protege, and it's kind of marketed like a horny teenager movie, but it's a lot more than that. Yeah. And I think the other reason why it didn't, part of it is also you had to get the soundtrack. I mean, there's music by Elton John, Cream, Blind Faith, Carole King. So I think getting the rights to it took it a while before it finally. But it's out on home video by Warner Brothers. I think it's Criterion worthy. So anyway, look for it's my favorite. That and Sideways are my favorite guy road trip films. So anyway, that is out there. Do you have a favorite moment? Because people have mentioned Moulin Rouge and Tiny Dancer and Almost Famous. This is the only time I accept an entire group of people singing at the same time. And it's because it's in a tour bus with musicians, not in a random restaurant with strangers. Do you have a favorite Elton John cinematic moment?
None that come to mind, unfortunately.
Have you seen Tommy?
I haven't.
Okay, he's pretty good in that too, as the pinball wizard for one scene.
I have the unfortunate age disparity where a lot of the movies that are notable for featuring Elton John came just before that area of time where I started like
breathing.
Really, no. Well, you know, yes, but also
okay,
as I work my way backwards,
yes,
slowly.
That's another column that's already been taken its name. Anyway, but you get the idea. So,
yeah.
All right. So, and oh, the other one I was mentioning was Aloha, Bobby and Rose, which I'm glad got a little bit of love with Paul LaMatt. So, okay. So that anyway, that's out there. I think shifting gears a little bit, there is one film that I saw that came out on video and DVD this week, and I'm glad I saw it because I was really bummed that I missed it in the theaters. The stalker thriller Greta.
Oh man, yeah, that's I have not made it to that yet, but
with Chloe Grace Moretz and Isabelle Huppert. That's the reason to see this.
Yeah.
And I forgot it's a Chloe plays a young girl who finds a purse that's left a handbag that's left on a New York subway. And she returns it, and it's owned by Huppert, who plays a lonely older woman. You know, and they spawn a friendship, and they adopt she adopts a dog, and then we find out that the old lady's crazy, and it becomes the stalker thriller that you expect, where you know she can't the young girl the young victim can't go to the police, everything's within the lines of the law, and things get worse and worse and worse. I didn't know until it opened in theaters that it was directed by Neil Jordan. So the man who gave us everything from The Crying Game to Michael Collins.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and yeah. It also reminded me he did the last time he attempted a thriller like this was called In Dreams with Annette Bening, and I need to see it. I remember it being bad. Yeah. I want to have a couple cocktails and watch it and see if it's fun bad. This one is, I will say, it, like I said, it follows all of the buttons. It follows all the rules that you need to have of the stalker thriller. However, it has a splendidly goofy performance from Isabelle Huppert. I heard that she was chewing scenery, and she does with a knife and fork and with some grace.
Yeah, she's the reason that I'm hoping to rent that movie as soon as I get a free hour to, or two
it's
hours
90
to
minutes.
To
That's the other
it.
Thing. Yeah. It's really quick. It's quick and to the point. It's got a little feminist slant to it because there's also one of the other central characters is the roommate who keeps telling her roommate, you know, stop hanging out with this crazy old lady.
Yeah.
Colm Feore shows up in this. It also has an Neil Jordan regular Stephen Ray shows up as a detective with a really ridiculous American accent. I love Stephen Ray, but not that you're not from New York, dude. It shows. But there, it's one of those films I had heard that she goes off the rails, but I wanted to see how she went off the rails. This is not Al Pacino in the last 10 minutes of The Devil's Advocate. That kind of thing where he is just he's chewing on walls. It's another reason why I want to, and I've not seen it, so I'm gonna probably have to wait till it comes out on video. The Dennis Quaid thriller, The Intruder. he has not chewed scenery since Great Balls of Fire 30 years ago.
Fellow critic Sam Watermeyer
does
had
he go
a very positive review of
does
it.
He go? I'm guessing he just goes bat spit crazy in the last third.
I've heard it's the Dennis Quaid that you don't get to see often enough.
Yes, like, that's what I want to see. So anyway, so if you want to see scenery chewing with grace and dignity, quiet dignity and grace, check out Greta.
Now, have you heard of another movie that came out this year? Have you heard of Ma, the Octavia Spencer?
Yes, that opens
movie?
This weekend as well. That's another one I'm like, oh, she's going to be good. She's going to be good even if the rest of the film is kind of dumb teenager movie.
It's such a great dumb trailer that like
didn't Chris Lloyd say it is trash. Knows it's trash, but it still has Octavia Spencer and just delivers.
Mitch Ringenberg at Midwest Film Journal also said basically the same thing where it's like, it's bad, but she's not So,
yes. So that balances it out.
Yeah.
So I guess you come for the badness, stay for the performance.
Yeah, we're looking at golden age of serious actors playing crazy stalkers.
It's there's something about watching it. My God. So anyway, that is also opening this weekend. So that for me is the big title. And because of Greta, I went into the archives. Yes, I found one of those films that, you know, you can only order online. Or as Kobe used to, you know, like Warner Brother Archives.
Yeah.
And by the way, this week, I'm very excited. Warner Brothers Archives now has on Blu-ray all three Shaft films.
Really?
Yes. I know there's another Shaft film coming later this summer. I'm not looking forward to it. Although Richard Roundtree gets some money. Good for him.
Yeah.
But have you seen the trailers for the new?
Yeah.
It's only because Kevin Hart is too old to play his son, apparently.
Yeah.
It feels like Ride Along. It's like Shaft meets Ride Along.
It's when, you know, it's directed and written by Tim Story.
Yeah.
He's not a name that I associate with good schlock. So.
No, that's bad schlock.
It's bad schlock. So, but I'll still see it. I mean, I'll watch it.
Yeah, I'm going to see it.
Yeah.
But the first three Shaft films, Shaft's Big Score, Shaft in Africa, all on Blu-ray. You're welcome. I still want Criterion to put out a Shaft box set, but that's just me. So anyway, from MGM UA's limited series, again, these are stuff you have to buy them online. You cannot get them in stores. Or as Kobe used to say, oh, I'd burn it for you for $5. There was that guy in college. But it was a stalker film I had heard of, had never seen, and then I found it at a certain shop for a certain amount of money, so I got it. A 1989 thriller called Lisa. Now, here's the premise. We have a 14-year-old girl with a single mom, and she and the girl and her BFF like to make crank calls on people, and especially if it's a good-looking guy. So and we see a scene early on where they crank call the BMV or they get somebody's license plate and they try to get the information. So the girl, the title of the film, Lisa, sees a handsome young man, gets his license plate info and basically finds out, gets his number and starts talking to him randomly. She does not know, however, that this man happens to be all over the newspapers as the Candlelight Killer.
Dun, of course.
Dun, dun. And yes, he's a lady killer. He's a serial lady killer whose big ploy is, and this is the opening scene of the film. She's checking the old voicemail because you have to press a button and the little tape rewinds. And he announces that he is in the house and he's going to kill her. That's space. So we're waiting for her to find out if he's a killer or not. So that's the premise of it. I still haven't checked to see what the young girl has grown up to work on. The mom is played by Cheryl Ladd of Charlie's Angels fame. So she works at a florist and she's very strict because she doesn't want her daughter dating until she's 16.
Of course not.
And the killer is played by a then young, I think fairly unknown, D.W. Moffat. So, and he works at a restaurant. And then there's a thing where he is flirting with Lisa and vice versa. And then he, you know, he wants to meet her because he wants another victim. And eventually they go, mom and Lisa go to his restaurant. Only Lisa has described the mother and not her. And so, yeah, way to go, 14-year-old kid, idiot. So this was what I believe what Roger Ebert would call an idiot plot, that things wouldn't happen if the protagonist of the film was not a complete idiot. Now, she's also 14, but with kids like this, who needs enemies? So, yeah, that's
feels like the kind of movie you'd find at a flea market on VHS for 50 cents.
Well, what's intriguing about this, because so I remember this coming out in college, and there was a period, of course, when there was any member of Charlie's Angels getting a film, you're as a guy, I'm like, huh.
Yeah.
Kind of that. It has a Skinamax gloss to it. It's got that kind of
sheen. Sounds appropriate for the...
Yeah. There's a lot of, and there's also a lot of, like, bad guitar riffs when something nefarious is about to happen. The only thing missing are the Red Shoe Diary wind and, you know,
yeah.
sheets are pillowing and curtains are flying, that sort of thing. But yeah, it has a kind of straight-to-DVD. It would have been a straight-to-DVD film in the 90s, yeah. And it could have been made as a TV movie in the 80s. But somehow, MGM UA let this out. And it's directed by, co-written and directed by a dude named Gary Sherman, whose other contributions to the cinema world include, and this sounded like something that would have been on the F Yeah Film Festival. Yeah. The first thing of note, he directed Rutger Hauer's film Wanted Dead or Alive.
Really?
With Gene Simmons as a villain. I believe this was Hauer's first action film in America as a hero. I think he did Lady Hawk and then got stuck in action movie hell. He also directed Poltergeist 3.
Wow.
Yeah. So...
Although, I've heard good things.
This was his follow-up. Yeah. So my guess is, okay, he must have got a two-picture deal with MGM UA, and they just kind of plopped this out there. It has a ridiculous climax at the end where the death is funny. And, it's not good. Well, I would say have a few and watch it. It's fun bad.
It's the kind of problem where you describe this movie to me, and at the end you say it's not good, and then I think, damn, I had to find that.
Yes, knowing you know what it is going in, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
So Jeffrey Tambor also shows up as the best friend's dad.
That's great
because it's 1989.
Yeah,
Tanya Fenmore is the best friend. Stacey Keenan is Lisa. That's right. That's the actress's name. So yeah, that's So I guess it's a morality tale. If you're a 14-year-old girl, don't crank call strangers because it might be a serial killer who's really handsome.
Crank calls are something that feel like they belong 30 years ago.
They don't do crank calls anymore.
No.
It's all done on the internet.
It's all nostalgia.
Yeah, that's one of those. The other thing that this film did for me is this is how I work with the other show. There's a couple scenes that happen in a grocery store. And I hear, is that Elmore James? And it was. So, yeah, I always go through the closing credits, and there's a song by Elmore James, Lightnin' Hopkins, Walter. I have half the Blue Show done because of this film alone. So thank you, filmmakers, for picking out Elmore James, Bo Diddley, Lightnin' Hopkins, and Big Walter Horton for the film, for the Blues House Party. Appreciate it.
This is a good value.
Yeah, that's that. Oh, God, there's also the... She gets also used as a plot device.
Yeah.
Your hand locking device on your keys. Because she sneaks into his car and she's hiding behind the driver's seat.
Yeah.
And he doesn't see her at all. Not at once. Not at all. So, yeah. So, anyway, look for it. I have a physical copy of it. I have no idea if it's streaming or whatnot. But, ladies and gentlemen, I'm one of the old guys that owns things. Because if you can't find it, I got it. So, yeah, that's. That is out there. and now Evan's going to look for it.
I'm going to go find that immediately.
Very good. So how old's the baby now?
2 months.
2 months.
Yeah.
How many times has it seen Paddington and Paddington 2?
He hasn't seen either. I'm saving those.
You're saving
special
them.
Special occasions.
What, until the memory kicks in?
Well, yes.
Okay.
And I can't watch those movies without, you know, crying, so.
Nothing wrong with crying in front of your child.
Yeah, you know.
No, I don't know. Now, here comes sage fatherly advice when it comes to cinema. I believe I told you this off the air, but you can watch anything in the first year.
Let me tell you what. That first month where the baby, you know, you can't train it to sleep in a certain way. You're just serving the baby. We're still in that phase.
Right.
I watched some movies that I watched the kind of movies that you only ever really watch when your significant other is asleep. Not you know, like I watched Gerard Butler's Den of Thieves twice for the Butler Did It column on Midwest Film Journal.
Yeah, I have to give you a lot of props because he's made some absolute garbage. And I just saw Angel Has Fallen. Are you going to watch that too?
Oh, certainly.
Oh, good Lord.
It's one of those things where we decided.
He even makes fun of his own movie choices.
He does. He admits that they're bad. We made this Butler Did It column. Nick Rogers suggested all of us taking on a different Butler movie or two. Just so happened to coincide with my paternity leave. So I ended up watching about half a dozen Gerard Butler movies to find the right one to really dig into.
And what was it?
Oh, Den of Thieves and The Ugly Truth with
Anne Heigl. That's an unpleasant rom-com. That's two unpleasant people.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Right about now, Katherine Heigl's changed her mind how she felt about the film.
Oh, yeah. It's but we.
The last thing I saw him in that I liked was Coriolanus.
Yeah, that was one of his like. Every five years he's in a good movie.
He's in a good movie.
Yeah.
When's the next one coming?
Well, it's not Angel Has Fallen. I don't think.
My God.
No, and I watched Olympus Has Fallen. I hadn't seen that before.
I saw the first one. That's more than enough. And that was the year when there were two White House Under Attack movies.
Yeah. And the weird thing is that's by. Antoine Fuqua, who made Training Day and Magnificent Seven remake, he makes good movies most of the time.
Not that time.
But
good God,
yeah. So I watched those with my son. I watched all five Die Hards.
Did you pause and show me in the second one?
I looked, and I couldn't find you. I had meant to ask you to.
I think I posted an image on Facebook, but I'll tell you later. Because if I talk about Die Hard on this show, that's braggadocious.
I actually also watched Hard Rain, which has a cameo by Richard Probst. You can see him in the back of a car at the very beginning because they filmed it in Indiana.
Yes, they did film it in Indiana. You put the
the IFJA cinematic claims to fame.
Did you put the broom through his wheel so he wouldn't go away? Hi, Richard. Sir Paul Hums, yes. God. Okay. So, as I said, you can watch anything in the first year, and you have, you're up on that. The moment that it changed, this day will come.
Yeah.
Now you have a film critic wife, so it might be different. But the turning point for me was, and I was the guy, whatever was at the top of the pile, I'm watching it.
Yeah.
Didn't matter. That's what I'm going for. So Emma's about two. And this was when we were at the Indianapolis house, and I'm in the living room. I'm watching the movie. I'm making hand gestures, which are great for radio. I can see the movie, but I can also, to my left is the kitchen, and she's in her little play saucer.
Yeah.
So, you know, you hear the ball spinning or the little balls in the thing, or the crank. You know, it's got the multi-purpose ball thing, play area. So I can see her while I'm watching the movie. And then Lynn came home. And it was not a major famous scene that was happening, but she did hear it, kind of poked her head. I was watching The Exorcist. And then she went to the kitchen, picked up Emma, and stormed upstairs. And as she was storming upstairs, I said, okay, I'll start to watch what I'm watching when the child is awake and downstairs with me. So you still got some time.
Yeah.
You got some time. But eventually... something's going to happen.
And then, he was born in March, so I'm expecting whenever he starts to notice to be around Oscar season when we start getting those screeners. So I'm curious what it'll be.
It's going to be plugged. Well, and of course, you're going to be in plug mode because you're like, I got to watch these as fast as possible so we can talk about them.
I'm sure in a few years I'll come on the show and have a story about something inappropriate I was
Emma
watching.
Emma has still yet to bring up the Wild Bunch at all. So, you know,
if
the other one, speaking of The Exorcist, I also believe in the long form joke. I was the only one allowed to clean Emma's face with a baby wipe. She didn't like anybody else wiping her face because when I would wipe her face, I would say, It burns. First time I did it, Lynn, I got sitcom wife look from Lynn. And eventually Emma started to go, it burns. So, of course, my wife looks at me and she goes, so when she's 18 and watches this film for the first time, I said, she's going to drop her head in shame. It already happened. A few years back, there was Emma had never seen it, and my buddy Kyle Zillick, hi Kyle, had never seen it. So we were watching it, but it was in the daytime, so it was okay. And we got to that moment. Emma just shot a look at me like, oh, yeah, that's where it happens. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So anyway, I'm sure you'll come up with something
that.
The other one, I'll tell it. When Emma was about two and we were riding, it was the first time she was riding the carousel at the Children's Museum. And... Lynn's on the ground taking pictures. I'm riding with Emma. She's on a horse. And we turn past Lynn, and I whispered in Emma's ear, and I had Emma bellow at the top of her lungs, "Ride, Equus, ride." Lynn gave me a sitcom wife look. Anytime Emma wanted a horsey ride, Daddy's horsey name was Equus. Going into her Harry Potter phase was when Daniel Radcliffe was doing the Equus revival with Richard Griffiths on Broadway, and all she heard was that there was a play and Harry Potter was getting naked. And I said, that's Equus. And then we tried to explain to her.
Yeah.
I explained to her the plot of the play and the movie Equus, and Emma was like, ew. Finally, at age 14, an Indianapolis theater company did a production of Equus. I knew people in it, and we saw the dress rehearsal. Because why not? And yeah. Apparently word had gotten out to the theater company, the Socies are coming, they're bringing Emma. Because I'd been telling this story for a long time.
Yeah.
And we get to end of act one, we get to intermission, and my lovely 14-year-old daughter turned to me and said, "What in the hell is wrong with you?" And she loved the film,
yeah.
Or loved the play. And she wound up reading the play. And then fast forward to a couple years later, we took her to see National Theater Live's production of Amadeus. I showed her the film, but she really, really dug this production. The musicians were on stage, and it was really, really cool. And as the credits are rolling, Emma says, "I really like this. What else has this guy written?" And we went, Equus. So, yeah. Anyway, go for the long form.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that you're planning a date to watch Paddington with your son.
You just got to save it for the right moment.
Save it for the right moment.
We do already have the red hat and blue coat sized for
I got to find a black hat. I'm that old. So I always, if you've ever seen Evan and I correspond, I'm so old. I remember when Paddington had a black hat. It's just how this was 80s animation. Sorry.
Yeah.
So, but you have the outfit ready.
We have it ready, and we did name him Luke, which is clearly after Star Wars, which we don't even deny to people. So
right.
He's already had infinite number of quotes spoken to him by us or our extended family that someday he'll see one of those movies and it will make sense.
Yep.
I assume.
Absolutely. The other one for, well, we named her Emma because we thought of a lot of the strong, independent, you know, Emma Goldman, Emma Thompson, Emma
yeah.
Peel, Jane Austen. 6 months after she was born was the season finale of Friends when Rachel had her baby. And we got flooded with calls that night. "Did you see Friends? She named daughter Emma." Oh, God. So now there was that thing of,
yeah.
And then of course ever since there's been a rise of Emmas, and I thought we're going to have to go through life saying, "No, we didn't name it because of Friends," even though Emma's a fan of the series.
Yeah.
So there is that. Be prepared that the first film you go into, you're not going to make it.
I have it's funny because the first film that I remember that I vaguely remember, but I'm mostly told I saw as a child, actually came to the fore in my memory recently because it was Aladdin, the animated Aladdin. So we recently saw the live action one.
Ah, the one in Blueface.
Yeah. So
did you like it?
I thought it was fine. I mean, I don't really like those live action Disney ones much.
But they're still going to keep making them whether we say anything or not.
But what's funny is the first time I went to see Aladdin, the Cave of Wonders tiger scared me so much I peed all over my aunt. So in the back of my mind, I've always thought to myself, you know, I got to prepare when, you know, if Luke is anything like me, I got to take him to something that can't possibly be terrifying. And then I think Aladdin's not terrifying. I was just a scaredy cat. So
no,
there's no preparing.
There will be, the first thing Emma went to, and I had to review it, was Racing Stripes.
Really?
Yes. The zebra. This was the live action film where a zebra, voiced by Frankie Muniz, wants to be a racehorse. And she was 4. And we got through it. Now, part of it was, you know, we had the booster seat. So, you know, every 20 minutes she's in the seat, she's on me, she's in the seat, she's on me. About halfway through, she's like, "Is this over?" But she stuck through it. Now, then there was, and sorry, Lynn, I love you, thank you. But I remember when the three of us went to see March of the Penguins, and about a third of the way through, she got really fussy. So Lynn took her out because I was on duty.
Yeah.
And they stayed in the lobby for the rest of the show. So anyone had to show it to her again on video. So
yeah.
So anyway, but since you're, you know, you have tag team film critics, just be prepared. It's just, and you have to go.
Yeah,
that's all there is to
it. We've already gotten into our shift arrangement that we aren't seeing movies together anymore. It's all right. You take this screening. I'll take this screening.
It's like Tedeschi Trucks. One of them is touring, and when the kids were younger, one would tour, and the other would stay at home, or vice versa. And then summer, everybody tours. Everybody goes together. So, good. Yeah. And eventually, there was a period where she would only watch animated stuff. I remember taking her to Zathura.
Yeah.
And that was a little intimidating. We were also like in the fourth row at one of the Greenwood theaters.
Oh, boy.
And so when the alien showed up, it was a lot of arm grabbing and that sort of thing. And then eventually she made the morph into live action stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing that you can do, and I've only had to do this once, there will be a film, it'll probably be an animated film, and it's going to be absolute garbage, and your kid's going to want to see it, and you're going to lie to your kid that the film's not there. I had to do this with Emma and Shark Tale.
Boy.
She saw the trailer for that and really wanted to see it, and I really didn't. And I remember I wound up seeing the film at a press screening. So I saw it in the evening without her, and it was trash. And I thought, I sure as hell am not going to sit through this a second time. And then, you know, Emma asked about it like 3 days later. I'm like, I think that movie's gone. That's the only film I had to do that with.
I've sometimes joked with Allie about, I'll say, you know, what if he gets really into Cars or one of those, you know, series that you don't care about? And she said, well, no one's going to show him that ever. I was like,
Wow.
All right.
So thank you, Lady Macbeth. That's the other one. There was a period where every day for 6 months, she watched either Monsters, Inc. or Finding Nemo. We got really, really, really lucky with those.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
those are both pretty good.
Those are both pretty good. Yeah, because if it was Scooby-Doo or something like that, I was like, no way. I'm not.
I have a friend whose daughter really liked Moana, and I was like, hey, you know, I could get behind that for 6 months.
So, yeah, I would say keep stuff out. You know, eventually he's going to want to grab stuff, so keep stuff within reach that you can handle watching every day. For months.
I'll just put Den of Thieves down low.
That's going to happen. That's going to happen. So the other thing, it's not film related, but I remember when she was really, really tiny and we had satellite and this is also shameless plugging, but PBS Kids Sprout.
Yeah.
24-hour young children's programming. And, because at first I thought, because we had PBS, we had regular PBS and the other, supplemental channels, but there was Sprout. And 24 hours, that's ridiculous. And, of course, 1 a.m., baby can't sleep. That's why you made it. Thank you. Thank you so much. So, when it's that late, then you need to do something, anything.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, Bob Bloom, so Bob runs his...
Bob would take his kids to the drive-in and see Hammer stuff. I know Bob's one of the elders of the IFJA, and
He regularly will, because he runs his Real Bob DVD column, Nickelodeon and other companies send him just tons of these children's animated, and all his grandkids are like in their teens now, so every time I see him at a screening, he has another like garbage bag of just like DVDs of kids stuff.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. So I have a big pile of just uncategorized stuff.
And you gotta wilt through it and wilt through it like no, maybe yes, no, maybe yes. Oh, that's cool.
Pretty cool. Yeah.
That's good.
He also, one time at a screening, he told me that I needed to start them on the classic Warner's cartoons early. So
yeah, that's pretty good. That's good advice.
It's good sagely Bob Bloom advice.
That is very good sagely Bob Bloom advice. And then show them the Vampire Lovers.
Of course.
kidding, not yet. Let's see. And of course, then there'll be the you're at this now of you're in the rocker.
Yeah.
You've got the remote. You went to the bathroom. You've got a drink. You're good for 3 to 4 hours.
If lucky.
Yeah. And then as time goes on, then it will be the rocking chair. You have the moat of pillows around the rocking chair, and then you're doing the Mission Impossible scurrying under the mat, and then you're trying to keep him on the rocking chair, is like Dr. Jones replacing the idol with a bag of sand. Yeah. Eventually you'll get there. And of course, the problem is when they're really, really young, they notice if the rocker stops.
Yes.
And so you're hoping that they're in a deep enough sleep that they're still, and then you can run to the bathroom and get other things done and then kind of wiggle back.
There's a time very early where I was just sort of seeing how many movies I could get in during a nap, and I was only able to get Waterworld in once.
Why?
I just got curious.
Oh, my God.
It's, you know, you watch something.
He drinks his own urine. Yeah, that kept you awake?
Yeah, I watched that and Dances with Wolves in the same week.
Same week, not the same day.
No. I don't think I could take that much Costner in 24 hours.
That's a lot. He's got a film coming up where he's the voice of a dog.
Oh, no.
It's a really long, bad title. But Amanda Siegfried's in it.
Yeah.
And he's the dog of a race car driver.
Oh, man.
And he's got the old Costner gravel voice now. Yeah. So, yeah, he's the voice of a dog. It's not like a Dog's Purpose mixed with Days of Thunder or some nonsense like that.
I'll watch it.
Of course you're going to watch it.
Yeah.
But I was working at a crummy video store in Carroll Springs, Illinois, when Waterworld came out. And my boss wondered why there was a boost in rentals of The Road Warrior. And I said, because I kept telling people to rent that instead.
Good call.
Oh, gosh.
It was on Hulu, and I noticed it, and I thought, I haven't seen that. I have a lot of good memories of the Stunt Spectacular Universal, so.
Ah, okay. You know. So, okay, but you're an odd Costner fan, but you haven't checked out Fandango, so now the pressure's really on.
I wouldn't call myself a fan of Costner, more of like a fascination with him.
Fine, then check, this is in his, of course, he's famous for not being in The Big Chill.
Yeah.
And then he had done some stuff, and then it kind of got re-released in his early years, and then it got re-released when he got famous. But Fandango, like I said, Fandango is one. It's really worth checking out because this is a role that he will morph into later as Crash Davis, as Tin Cop, as the likable kind of scoundrel with a lowercase s.
Yeah.
You know, nothing too nefarious or illegal, just kind of morally. Anytime he works with Ron Shelton, it's always good. But there's that. And then like a year later, Lawrence Kasdan kind of gave him the ultimate consolation prize, which was Silverado.
Yeah.
So that's not a bad, for the good news, the bad news, and then the good news is this is the part that's going to break through for you.
Yeah.
So anyway, I hope you can check that out.
I should do that.
But yeah, Waterworld, man.
Not.
He drank his pee.
Kept me awake. So,
I bet it did. Where they have enough matches to light those things.
Yeah.
And old Dennis Hopper, just talk about chewing scenery right there.
Oh, so great. I mean, that's a word to describe it, but
in its own, yeah. Just like I think The Room is a great experience.
It is a great experience. I mean, let's be real. I mean,
going back to Gerard Butler.
Yeah.
I use these analogies as far as people who are just like, why are you making this? Like Olivier in the 70s. Because I know he wanted money for his family and to get the National Theater up and running. De Niro in the 90s to get Tribeca up and running. I get that.
Yeah.
But, and Johnny Depp because he's got bad debt. So I understand. But like guys like Hopkins, I don't think Hopkins ever said anything. But, Butler is like, is he
working to work?
They just throw him, and I know his films also make money overseas.
Oh, tons!
So he's kind of like the 21st century's. He's like Sly and Arnold in the 90s.
He is.
Where it's like, why is this garbage still being made? Oh, because it makes a gajillion dollars in Asia and Europe.
It's funny. We finished writing The Butler Did It, and everyone took a different role, and Allie got to cover the Phantom of the Opera, where he has to sing, which is. Oh, my. That was...
Well, also, one of the all-time great screenplay credits, screenplay by Joel Schumacher and Andrew Lloyd Webber.
I did watch that.
He screams at you.
It was... Oh, my
and
gosh.
And I know my buddy Kayla, that is her favorite musical, and she loves that film, but he is...
No.
Nope.
But it's funny. I spoke to the fellow writers at the Midwest Film Journal when we were discussing our next group writing projects, because that's, like, the thing that we like doing on our site the most. And I said, what if we go back to the Butler well, we do Butting Heads, and we talk about two Butler roles against each other? Because that man has starred as more, like, stern, but kind of kind of funny, kind of stern, like morally forthright male lead characters than any other actor working today. Not unlike Sly Stallone or like or Arnold in the 80s. Like he has a type of character. And Nick said no. We're never going back to the Butler Will ever again.
Now you in P.S. I Love You. See, it would even be something if he when he did comedy because he did P.S. I Love You, and of course he got trounced because he's a Scotsman doing an Irish accent.
Yeah.
And that's a much bigger deal overseas than it is here. But I know he got trounced for that, and he's done like I know the Bounty Hunter.
Yeah.
It's not as unpleasant as The Awful Truth, but
his characters are always just. They're of an ilk.
I remember Paul Rudnick writing about this was back in the Premiere magazine days.
Yeah.
When he was under the pen name of Libby Gexman Wexler, but there should be like a reboot of Full House, but it's Bruce Dern, James Woods, and Christopher Walken. So ever since then, you use the analogy like you need to be a wacky dad. Like Gerard Butler needs to be a wacky dad sometime soon. I mean, Mark Wahlberg's playing dads now, so it's a matter of time, I guess. Wacky dad who doesn't have to rescue his kid.
He could fit very well into the daddy's home model of like just like
so. In about 10 years, he's gonna.
Oh man, yeah.
Oh
he's
god,
he's gonna star with some comedian, and it's gonna be like. Super bad taste, but somehow you're just gonna enjoy it.
And he's not gonna understand the comic as a person off camera.
Right,
just not gonna get their humor.
No,
man. So, yeah, I wish there was a habit. I wish there was a film festival or something. I wish he was doing theater on the side. That would explain. Like Liam Neeson has been kind of going through that. I'm like, okay, he's working with Scorsese. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I'm like, if you were putting, build an Irish theater, do James Joyce, do something so you can
contribute
Battleship
something.
And Taken 3 and all that stuff. So anyway, Gerard, enjoy those checks, man.
I think he does.
He does.
Oh, man.
So what is coming up next at the Midwest Film Journal?
Yeah, so in addition to always providing news and reviews we're doing, Allie and I are doing I don't think I've ever told the Guy Pearce story on the show.
Oh, please do.
Real quick. So Allie and I, we went on our first date to see Man of Steel, coincidentally, back in 2013, the Superman movie.
You guys are all right.
It was a pretense to go on a date.
Your pick or her pick?
Both. It was mutual pick.
Okay.
That sort of... mutual pick, mutual sitting there afterwards going, it was okay, it was all right, because you're on your first date, you don't want to be like,
and that's the time he decides to defy his father.
Yeah.
Also Kevin Costner.
it's all connected.
Yeah.
But so Guy Pearce had long been my favorite actor, but very few people at Ball State in my film circles back there, including Sam Watermeyer, really understood the fascination with an actor who's mostly in terrible roles, not unlike Gerard Butler, taking every role he can possibly get, showing up in weird places like the Time Machine. But he had at least had LA Confidential at the time.
LA Confidential, yeah. Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Proposition at the time.
Yeah,
so he has a much better resume than Gerard Butler.
Memento.
But he stars in a lot of bad stuff. And I watched all of it. I watched every single movie he made from 1992 to 2010.
Even the Errol Flynn one?
I own that movie.
Of course
I loaned it to Chris Lloyd.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not good. Me and Allie tried to watch that 2 months ago. Didn't fly. But so we're standing there in line. Afterwards, we go for coffee. We're talking. And she's, I don't know how we got on the topic, but she says, we're talking about Count of Monte Cristo. She says Guy Pearce is one of her favorite actors.
Wow.
And I'm like, Guy Pearce is one of your favorite actors? I called my twin sister afterwards. I'm like, Ellen, I met this girl, and she loves Guy Pearce. So at our wedding, my sister, of course, brought up that phone call in her maid of honor speech. And so me and Allie are finally going to do it. We're going to do Our Guy. We're going to do a month of us covering a number of Guy Pearce movies that we've either watched together or watched separately.
Uh-huh.
Just... lay it all out there.
Wow.
Mostly, I'm just really, I need to use that pun before another movie site does.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Wow. Yeah, I'm trying to think of the last thing I saw him in that I liked.
I mean, he has this thing now where he's in tiny roles in big movies.
Well, he works. I remember he had a bit part in Animal Kingdom. I loved Animal Kingdom, and I think First Snow.
First
him
Snow.
And J.K. Simmons. I really liked that.
I enjoyed that movie
a lot.
That
was cool. It helps balance out bedtime stories. And
he was in...
Remind me again, the Die Hard in the space.
Lockout.
That's like a couple cocktails and watch, right?
There's a...
Bad?
You know, I guess there are two movies that Allie has told me to turn off. Armageddon and Lockout.
Wow.
And I had this fond memory. Sam Watermeyer and I, fellow critic, we're going to Ball State together. I'm into Guy Pearce. Lockout's coming out. I'm like, oh, I love Escape from New York. I love Guy Pearce.
That's right. It was more Escape from New York. Sorry.
Me and Sam go in. We do our college ritual of buying a Blizzard and then sneaking the Blizzard into the movie theater.
See, really?
And I had I loved Lockout. So I bought it a couple months ago. I was like, Allie, you have to see this. It's Guy Pearce trying to be an
action star.
How
long did she last?
It couldn't have been 20 minutes.
Wow. There's
a line that he has that I'm not going to repeat on air.
Thank you.
But it's worth it because it's like the first quote on IMDb, and it's the most nonsensical insult, most nonsensical your mom joke ever heard in my life.
Okay, now everybody's going to be hot. It's hot keyboard clicking action.
And it's delivered by a man who just cannot play an action hero. I love Guy Pearce.
All right.
It's
Yeah, I
it's
was great. Telling him off air way back in 2001, 2000, early 2003. I was a film critic on Fox 59 AM. Yes, myself and Jonathan Marcandy. Hello. And I remember reviewing Time Machine and Count of Monte Cristo. And I remember he came off as a surly Mick Jagger in Count of Monte Cristo. And
it was also a choice.
Yeah, was a choice. And it was Jim Caviezel before he was, flogged to death.
Yes.
For hours on end. And also Richard Harris had that brief upswing because he had just done Dumbledore.
Yeah.
And then he was in this and Gladiator. So he was having a nice resurgence. But I remember reviewing The Time Machine. And if you've not seen this, you're not missing much. The Rod Taylor version doesn't have to worry. But it's a starring role in a major Hollywood film, so of course he's going to take it. I understand that.
Yeah.
But it looks silly. And Jeremy Irons shows up near the end, who looks like if you took Christopher Lee from Lord of the Rings and made him an albino. Sorry to my albino friends.
You can barely tell it's him.
Except for the voice. He has the great Jeremy Irons voice. And I remember we showed it, and that was the clip we shot. Was the scene with that's the big money scene between Pierce and Irons. And I looked at the camera and said on morning television, I didn't realize the world was taken. No, if you know your candies, Jeremy Irons is a giant zero bar. And that's what he looked like.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the review, I pulled up a zero bar I got from a vending machine. And then said, of course, apparently in the future, the world's being run by Edgar Winter, which isn't all bad. So I did an unannounced product placement and 70s classic rock reference on a morning show. I got called into an office.
It's probably the most exciting review of The Time Machine.
My God.
The story's better than the movie, which
I've kind of was. Yeah,
it
kind of was. I'm happy when Guy Pearce says, oh, The Proposition.
Yeah.
So
I love that
when
movie.
I think it's like Shaq at the free throw line, or it's like Bo Diddley when he was performing.
Yeah.
When he's on, and when he's not, oof.
He's just sailing along.
Right. So I get excited when there's good Guy Pearce.
Yes. I
When's
do
it
too,
happening again?
We're gonna publish that hopefully midsummer. He's in a couple movies this year still. He was in Brian De Palma's movie that was released.
Yes, you saw Domino.
Yes.
Not to be confused, not the Keira Knightley, Tony Scott film. It's one of Brian De Palma's low-budget affairs. And
so he filmed it in 2017 with a couple stars of Game of Thrones and Guy Pearce doing a Texan accent for some reason. He's Australian.
Because he can.
He's doing it. And they filmed it in 2017. The producers took control from him, and people thought it was never going to see the light of day. But what's happened is it's been released on VOD, and it's in a form that's only comparable to The Room. in the way that it's you know, it's clear they just took dailies and spliced them together in a vaguely coherent narrative arc. And so you have these scenes that are just so cardboard and strange. It's almost unsettling, but it's like immaculately watchable in how odd it is.
Okay.
I said in my review on Midwest Film Journal that, you know, you can take all of De Palma's movies. You know, you have half a dozen Criterion Collection editions of his movies.
Yes.
You could have spent hundreds of dollars on those. But at some point, you're going to look at those. And then you're going to look at Domino, and you're going to watch the fail video version of a De Palma movie where, you know, the guys, you know, like you go on YouTube and look at a fail video. Someone's flying off their bike over their handlebars.
Yeah.
That's what this is. It's really interesting just because of who it's coming from and how odd
you,
it is.
Yeah, I think you said it's like The Room, but with an A-list.
Yes.
An A-list talent.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, it's really strange and interesting.
And I read, because the only other review I read was in the AV Club, and they didn't like it either. They drew comparisons to Femme Fatale.
Yeah.
Especially at the beginning. Everyone's favorite feminist director, Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
Wow.
There are those, I mean, you can tell. I mean, there is a script that he was working from, and there are parts where you're like, oh, okay.
But the producers kind of edited the film, threw the film together.
It almost feels inappropriate to add it to the rest of his movies and say, you know, oh, this is another
one he made. He should have Alan Smithied this, what you're saying.
It feels like it, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, it's interesting, though.
Because the last thing of his I remember seeing was Passion. It was Rachel McAdams and Rooney Mara, if I remember right.
Yeah, he's been out of the loop for a little while.
And of course, he is of my era, because I remember when a De Palma film was an event.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, things kind of went astray. And I remember reviewing Femme Fatale on Fox and really, really liking it. And wishing, it was one of those kind of like Bogdanovich. Well, most of the 70s directors, it was a big deal, and now it's just kind of an afterthought. Although I'm looking forward to The Irishman. Although I'm not sure I'm up for sandblasted Pacino and De Niro.
I'm really curious to see how that feels in the moment.
And I know they, I saw the trailer for Gemini Man, which is directed by Ang Lee.
Yeah.
And they're doing it with Will Smith.
I'll give Will Smith, you know, I even liked him as the genie in that new Aladdin movie. I'll give Will Smith the time of day, even though, you know, we were talking with Richard Probst about it on Facebook the other day.
Mm-hmm.
He's not necessarily done the best to deserve a clean slate with every movie he makes, but I grew up in the 90s. Like, I even love Wild Wild West, so I'll give Will Smith I'll give him a chance no matter what.
You haven't watched Collateral Beauty, have you?
I have not watched Collateral Beauty.
Between that and After Earth, he lost a lot of that.
Yeah.
So the fact that he's got an upswing with Aladdin, good for him.
Yeah.
So the sandblasting, and it's become a thing now.
Yeah.
My favorite is in the second Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, with Kurt.
Where you airbrush Kurt Russell, but you do nothing to filter out his Hateful Eight gravel voice. Right? I mean, seriously, you couldn't put that through a filter and make him sound like it was 1975?
Yeah.
It would be like, and of course, I think the next person who's up for getting airbrushed, Nick Nolte. And I know he plays Gerard Butler's dad in Angel Has Fallen, but nobody's done an airbrush of him so he looks like he's in Rich Man, Poor Man, but he still sounds like Nick Nolte.
I cannot see any CGI allowing Nick Nolte to look like young Nick Nolte again. I laughed out loud when I saw him show up in that Angel Has Fallen trailer.
See, I love cinematic gene pools. I want to know what Gerard Butler's mom is in a limb. If Nick Nolte, if bearded, hiding in the woods, survivalist Nick Nolte is your father.
Yeah.
Not since National Treasure, where apparently John Voight plus Helen Mirren equals Nicolas Cage. That's not happening.
That's a stretch.
That is a real stretch. So it's one thing if you leave the mom or the dad out, so you just have kind of a what? The all-time great one is a 1989 Sidney Lumet film called Family Business, where the grandson is Matthew Broderick, his dad is Dustin Hoffman, His granddad is Sean Connery. Not kidding.
Huh.
That's a film.
That's a
film.
That's a family tree.
That's a family. I have no idea what the moms look like in this family.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. So, once again, where can people go to read your work?
Yeah, go to MidwestFilmJournal.com. That's where all of our work is published. We're doing our Guy Pearce one. We're doing a Star Wars one to commemorate the next one at the end of the year. And the Godzilla posts are all up and done for now.
And then you'll eventually you have the Gamera stuff.
Yeah.
I'm making you watch Fandango eventually.
Yes.
And
I'll be watching the Gameras, but there are 8 King Kong movies and there is a King Kong movie next year. So
you're set. You're
preparing. I just have to figure out the pun.
There you, of course.
Yep.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people, Zardoz is stolen. Don't show Luke those yet. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's some out there. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.